Gotta say, even LeBron James cannot make as much as the movie Avatar. Around the world, people have spent more than $1 billion to see a human who defends the blue-skinned natives of a moon called Pandora. So that's one of two big hits we're about to discuss. The other is the number one single on the Billboard Hot 100 right now, TikTok by Keisha. NPR's Netta Ulaby and Zoe Chase say these two hits have something in common. They are both totally derivative.
Okay, Zoe, when I saw Avatar, I was overwhelmed by how everything in the story has been in some other movie. Every other movie.
You are not in Kansas anymore. You are on Pandora.
The Wizard of Oz, The Last of the Mohicans.
You know, Pocahontas had the Tree of Life, just like Avatar.
Right.
And the movie is just the ultimate mashup of colonialist fantasies that we've all seen, like The Last Samurai, Lawrence of Arabia.
Outsider wants to be the natives.
To become Aronyu, hunter, you must choose your own Ikran, and he must choose you.
When?
When you are ready.
Outsider wants to save the natives.
Outsider becomes king of the natives. Dances with wolves.
I'd never really known who John Dunbar was. Perhaps the name itself had no meaning. But as I heard my Sioux name being called over and over, I knew for the first time who I really was.
So, Zoe, do you suppose that James Cameron was purposefully trying to reference all of these movies when he made Avatar?
One would hope so. Netta, there's a song at the top of the pop charts right now, and it's called TikTok, and it's also incredibly derivative of basically every major theme that's ever run through pop music, ever. Don't stop, make it pop, DJ, blow my speakers up. Tonight, I'ma fight till we see the sunlight. The lyrics mean nothing, and the song is about nothing, and it's not actually a very good song, in my opinion, but it sounds enough like a good song so that you can't quite tell the difference.
You know, when you listen to that song, you can't help but notice how heavily produced it is.
I know. The producers took her voice and just ran it through over and over and over. And the production process is kind of the same with Avatar. You know, it's just laid on so thick, you can't help but think about how produced it is.
Yeah.
Build me up, you break me down, my heart it pounds, yeah, you got.
What's the singer's name again?
It's Kesha. And yes, that is spelled K to the E to the dollar sign to the H to the A.
She spells her name with a dollar sign?
Yeah.
When you channel and put together so many pop, cultural, and hip-hop memes, but you don't have a real story to tell, you kind of got nothing. Which is why Avatar is an unbelievably brilliant picture to look at, but the story just doesn't match the visuals in terms of the sophistication. And, you know, if it did, it would be best picture.
And that's exactly what you hope for in a situation like this with a movie like Avatar that has so much behind it, or in TikTok, which everybody is listening to, is that some genius producer has created this montage of tropes next to each other, like a bunch of movie scripts in a blender, to make a larger point. But if you're just employing a bunch of tired old tropes and you don't have a smart point to make about it, then you're just tired.
You know what? At least they're provoking us and probably tons and tons of other people to have a conversation.
I'm Zoe Chase.
I'm Netta Ulaby, NPR News. Don't stop, make it pop,
DJ, blow my speakers up. This is the montage of tropes we like to call Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Madeline Brand.
And let's hear next from somebody who's a regular on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, where he wears many different hats.
I'm joined by senior foreign affairs correspondent Jon Oliver. Forming our senior literary correspondent Jon Oliver joins us. For more, I'm joined by senior presidential historian Jon Oliver. Jon, thank you so much for joining us.
Yes, Jon Oliver, also known as the senior British correspondent.
And soon he'll be known for a new show. Tomorrow night, Jon Oliver's New York stand-up show will debut on Comedy Central. Jon Oliver joins us to discuss his comedy, but first let's hear a clip from his show.
3.5 years I've lived here. I work hard, relatively speaking, for someone who does this for a living. I pay my taxes. I try to fit in. I've learnt your rudimentary language. I don't know what more you can reasonably expect me to do. And that's when it hit me. I know why I'm so angry. I know what this is. Taxation without representation.
That's John Oliver opening his new show, John Oliver's New York Stand-Up Show. So you have some deep anger there about not being able to vote in America, even though you've been here for a very, very long time.
Yeah, I think, anger is a very well-chosen word. Resentment, a sense of complete injustice, all of that. I mean, yeah, I understand that people laughed when I paused during that piece of spoken word, but they were wrong to do so. That was a very... very sincerely meant from the heart sentiments.
Well, do you even have a green card?
Yeah, I do now. Thank you. Now you sound like a US immigration officer. Actually, I do. As of just at the end of last year, I finally now have a green card. So, yes, I do. And I still don't get to vote.
Well, what do you plan to do about it?
Well, I'm in the process of getting a very elaborate red coat stitched up, and then I will get my musket dusted and polished off, and then I'm taking this country back. You leave me no other choice.
So you're actually going to be an anti-Tea Partier.
Yeah, absolutely. Those Tea Party people don't know what's it. They've had it too easy all the last 12 months. The British are coming. We'll show you what tyranny really is.
Well, why are you so eager to become an American, or at least to vote or to be part of our ways?
It's not so much that I'm eager to be American as I'm eager for you to be British once more. I still see this as very much our land. No, I love it here. That is the truth. And so I want to stay. So I was very anxious to get a green card because life on a visa can be perilous.
Well, how did you get here in the first place? Because you have only been here for 3 years, and yet here you are on The Daily Show, and it's, you know, it's not some small, tiny club in a small town. This is the big time for a comedian.
It's the big times within the times of basic cable. Yeah, you're right. But no, I was working and writing in England, and then I got offered this job. I hadn't been to America before, so it was very strange. It was my favourite show as I was in England. So coming here the first day was very, very strange.
You can watch The Daily Show in England?
Yeah, I watched it online, and now it's also on in England.
Really?
Yeah, we have televisions there too.
Shocking. So you've been working on The Daily Show since 2006, and you do a lot of these sketches where you go out on assignment and play the straight man and ask ridiculous questions of people. Do all of them know that you're a comedian and kind of poking fun?
They know what the show is, and I guess when you sit down opposite someone, you often do have something at the back of your mind thinking, why are you here? Why are you doing this? If you know the show, why are you doing this? And the truth is, they just want to be on TV. That is the great Achilles heel that we're able to kick every time. People want to be on TV. Politicians, it might be like a gamble or something. They know that we have a viewership who actually vote. So I guess it's a control gamble the whole time. They know the show, though.
It didn't seem like that when you interviewed the Swiss UN ambassador recently on the show.
Okay. That's possibly true.
When you sat down with this ambassador,
yes,
and you started, you know, making fun of Swiss neutrality, mm-hmm, and
yeah,
but then towards the end it gets really sticky and uncomfortable, not only for him but for the viewers, and you can hear some uncomfortable laughter in the audience. Well, let's hear that.
So easy to take a position on neutrality, hard to take a position on Hitler.
We did take strong positions on Hitler and many other things. We just didn't participate in the war. That's two different things.
Would it be possible for me to keep my gold here? Ah, Adolf, of course. Lovely to see you again. Come back in. What have you been up to? Actually, don't tell me. I want to be able to say I don't know.
At that point, were you going for the humor or were you going for something else?
Yeah, I'm always going for the joke. It's a comedy show, so that is the most, that is the priority. And yet you also want to try and get, especially with where you have interesting opportunities like sitting down with the ambassador, you want those jokes to illuminate something. And so the discussion you're referring to was really about neutrality during the Second World War and whether that is appropriate, whether neutral. And have to give him credit that he stands by it. You know, it's an all-in process, neutrality, you go for it, and then it is self-interest to its logical conclusion.
You probably get this question 100 times, but is there a big difference between British and American humor, do you think?
No, not really. No, that's the quickest way to answer that. The longest way is that I guess there are similar reference points, or, you know, reference points have to change in a minor way, but so much of comedy is cross-cultural between the UK and the US. We get each other's stand-up comedians a lot and each other's comedy shows. So it isn't that much different. The only real difference in live comedy is alcohol level, which is significantly higher in the UK. Significantly higher.
On the part of the performers or the audience?
Well, both, but especially the audience.
Yeah. So is it a lot more raucous?
Yes, it is. It's a lot more raucous. There's a lot more, people really have come for a dialogue when they go to a stand-up show in the UK. They say, yeah, I understand that you have now finished your little comic monologue. Now I have something to say regarding what I've just heard.
Maybe that's why you like the US better.
That could be it. The US is, surprisingly, more polite.
Well, John Oliver, thank you very much.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure.
John Oliver, Daily Show correspondent and host of the new show, John Oliver's New York Stand-Up Show. This is a very polite morning edition from NPR News. I'm Madeline Brand.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
Before Nintendo Wiis and Sony PlayStations, there were pinball machines. Pinball may be history for today's generation of gamers, but it's a history that David Silverman wants to preserve. In the past 30 years, Silverman has collected 867 pinball machines, from 1920s flat box games designed to be played on bar tables to today's freestanding computerized games with music and sound effects. One day, he hopes to open a national pinball museum where his prized possessions will be on display. For now, they reside in a building he constructed behind his house in Silver Spring, Maryland. Silverman works as a landscaper, specializing in Japanese gardens. But he found the time this past week to show us his collection of pinball machines and explain how his passion for pinball began.
I immediately was attracted by the color and the artwork, and as a four-year-old. I mean, I was just fascinated with it. And my father gave me a bunch of nickels. From that point on, as they say, you know, history in the making.
Take us to a game of that era.
Oh.
When you were four.
Yes, okay.
See if we can squeeze by these. The slick chick.
Yeah, this game. Coronation would be a game of my era. Now, realistically, I would say I'm an average player. Not above average, and I think probably when I was a young kid, I was a better player than I am now, and most of the people I know who are older players feel the same way.
Look at you, racking up.
Yeah,
million.
I got a million. And to get a free game, you have to get 5,200,000, and all I have is 2 million, so I'm a kind of a pathetic player.
Now, we happen to be backed into another game, which appears much, much older.
How old
is this game?
This game's about 1929.
Right. So there's no flippers.
No flippers.
What there are there these silver balls, and you put some nickels up here. Does that mean I can put it in?
Absolutely.
All my balls come out.
Now you shoot it.
Okay. Do you want me to shoot it?
Oh, yeah, you got two balls in one time.
All right, let's see what I got. Missed. Yeah, that's where they all end up. Did you restore this game?
Yes, yeah.
And that's what you do as well. You restore games, you collect games.
Display games.
Display games. You let people come in and play games.
Yes.
And your ultimate goal is to actually have a pinball museum.
What I'm trying to do is save American history, because these pinball machines go along the lines of history. The game you looked at before, Coronation, was when Queen Elizabeth was coronated.
Really?
So this was...
Pinball was made in honor of...
Exactly. And so many of the games that you see here have a lot to do with what was happening at the time. The artwork is similar as well.
I have to stop you, though, but Queen Elizabeth, I've never seen her in a bikini, wearing a fuchsia cape with those little platform ankle shoes that they wore in 1950, blonde hair, something like, you know, Betty Grable or...
Well, you have to remember that pinball was a man's game.
A lot of the pinball machine, the height of pinball was after World War II. So the soldiers coming home who were used to pin up girls in their lockers, basically all the artwork, what we call the back glass, was to attract the player. And what was on them? Mostly women.
You're actually standing in front of Coronation.
Correct.
But it is flanked by Sweet Adeline. Roto Pool is next to Coronation. Nine Sisters is next to it, and Green Pastures is next to that one. These seem to be a heyday of pinball. But they were always in these dark, kind of nefarious places. When did pinball become kind of a social no-no?
That was actually pretty early. The company called Bally invented a payout game. And once these games were invented, that was gambling. So pinball was outlawed in the three major cities that were important for pinball. That was New York City, that was Chicago, and that was L.A. But not until 1976 did they finally legalize pinball in New York City.
Okay, so it's, you know, the middle of a Sunday afternoon, and you've got the urge to play some pinball, and you say, I'm going to go down to my museum, such as it is at this point, and I want to play a game. What game do you choose to play?
Well, there's a game right next to you called Big Bang Bar. That is my favorite game.
All right, come on over. Let's take a look at this thing.
The black light will come on. And it changes the color. All of the greens, all of the colors, especially when the room is dark, which is what I like to play pinball in.
Now, this has things modern that I recognize. The little tracks where balls go, the ramps, the kind of in and out and down and above. I mean, this is really bells and whistles.
And that this is called the attract mode. This is quite innovative because, watch, it'll tell you the story.
On the night of July 2nd, 1947, a loud crash was heard near Roswell, New Mexico. Remains of an alien spacecraft were recovered, although this was officially denied by the United States government. Was this craft an advance scout of an impending alien invasion of Earth, or was it simply an accident by a group of joyriders having one too many?
At the Big Bang Bar.
At the Big Bang Bar.
Anybody who comes in here who looks reputable can play the games for nothing.
All right, how do I look?
You look pretty reputable.
All right, I think I'm going to play this game.
Press that button.
Like I'm going to get that far.
Player one, Ray wants to see you at the bar.
Ray wants to see you at the bar. Well, where's Ray?
Oh, Ray's up there.
All right.
You have 13 million so far.
Player all right. One, I need to see some
IQ. Hey, I'm old enough. Come on.
Top stands.
Ah!
Well, watch what happens when the game's over.
If you're willing, I say.
Watch. What happens when you're in a bar?
And drink too much?
You throw up.
David Silverman, thank you for showing us your collection of pinball machines, and good luck with the Pinball Museum.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Would you mind if I played Adam's Family?
Of course. Good shot.
Ah! Where did that come from? That's not fair.
This is NPR's Weekend Edition, directed by Ned Wharton and produced by Kimberly Adams, Sarah Beyer Kelly, Peter Breslow, Elaine Heinzman, Veronica Miller, Thomas Pierce, Gemma Waters, and Habiba Noshin. Our technical director is Burke Hunn. Our librarian is Kim Oleski. Melissa Goh is our web producer. Our show was produced today by Walter Ray Watson. Our senior editor is Tony Marcano. The senior producer of Weekend Edition is Devar Iran Ardalan. And on a bittersweet note, we say goodbye today to producer Charla Bear. It will be impossible for us to calculate our loss. In the past year alone, Charla has produced and reported pieces from a Washington, D.C. high school to Los Angeles farmers market to the extreme southern tip of Argentina. We've had the good fortune of benefiting from her amazing work and professionalism. and we've had the distinct pleasure of her collegial company and good cheer. Our loss is public radio's gain. Charlotte is moving to Seattle to report for member station KPLU. So send us your best work, Charlotte. Happy birthday, and remember, keep your thumbs up while dancing. I'm Leanne Hansen.
Many of us these days spend time online at social networking sites, Facebook, say, or MySpace or LinkedIn. And if you use those sites, you know how easy it is to happily fritter away hours in the Twitterverse or some other online community. But what happens if you get sick of all those messages on your Facebook wall? Well, the brains behind a website called Web 2.0 Suicide Machine offer this encouragement to end it all. Virtually.
It doesn't make your life better. You always think you're missing something. And above all, it makes you more stupid.
Gordon Savicich is the CEO, which he says stands for Chief Euthanasia Officer of SuicideMachine.org. He joins us on the phone from Vienna. And tell me, the idea here is what? To abandon your virtual life so you can get your actual life back?
Well, that was certainly one of our intentions. Basically, we try to remove as much content as possible. We changed the profile picture and the password, so you can't log in anymore.
So what happens if I were to go log into suicidemachine.org? Mm-hmm. What do I see? How does it work?
What happens is you click commit, and then you see
click commit.
A pop-up.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. There you see basically a remote desktop session, so you see how a web browser is being started. And then, depending on the service you chose, you will see that the machine logs into your account. You see your friend list, and then basically the machine starts, based on our scripts, to remove the friend connections of everyone. Or in case of Twitter, we remove the followers and the people you follow. It changes your profile picture, changes your password, and finally it logs out.
So one by one, deleting your friends online. You watch them disappear.
You can take time and relax in front of the computer and see how your 2.0 life is passing away.
What happens if you change your mind halfway through?
That's a problem.
That's a problem.
Because we can't stop it, and also the process.
Well, have you had a lot of interest? How many people have signed up?
We have around 900 users. And since last Sunday, Facebook blocked our service.
Facebook has blocked your service.
They basically didn't like the idea that we are unfriending other people's accounts. And we still have to decide how we react on that.
That's Gordon Savicich from SuicideMachine.org, which will help you commit social media suicide. It's the idea of a group called Modder. That's a bunch of artists, designers, and programmers based in Rotterdam. Facebook released a statement earlier this week saying Suicide Machine violates their rules of user interaction. The company says it is, quote, currently investigating and considering whether to take further action. This is NPR News.